are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 26, 2017, on a Michael Brooks Wednesday on the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Donald Trump unveiling massive corporate tax cuts, giveaways to the rich. Sounds like the perfect Republican plan, but they might not even be able to pass this monstrosity through this monstrous GOP Congress. Is that how big a fail these people are? Nothing to point to besides a Supreme Court justice and some more environmental pollution and public health damage. And Yemen aid conference agrees to give significant resources to that country, but will it go to the right places? Probably not. And we will check back in on the Saudi war there with U.S. endorsement that has been pummeling the civilian population of Yemen for quite some time now. A judge rejects Trump's latest tantrum to cut money off from sanctuary cities, and he just can't believe that there are all these judges that stop him from doing unconstitutional things. And he's back to calling the Muslim ban again in his latest Twitter tantrum. Moving into the second round of France's general election, Emmanuel Macron and Marie Le Pen showing us the grotesque and disturbing choice and dangerous choice between neoliberalism and neo-fascism. Two sides of the same coin in some respects, although obviously fascism is always worse. Republicans are cooking up a new plan to gut health care. They're going after pre-existing conditions, and one thoughtful rep wanted to carve out a specific exemption to people who might be affected by that plan. Members of Congress and their staffs. And Barack Obama, he's back in the news, and he's going to take a big payday for a speech to Wall Street that even people like Matthew Iglesias get is a bad idea. All that and more on today's Majority Report. No guests today. We're crewing it. Sam is in Vegas. He is gambling. He is talking about the law. He is drinking. He is talking about Social Security and the law. He's finding tort lawyers who are explaining new obscure lawsuits that he's getting deeply excited about. And he'll have full coverage for you from Vegas tomorrow with that great new setup we have with that impeccable sound quality. We are going straight into the news, sans guest. So the phone lines are on, the IMs are on, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I want to start just briefly, get this out of the way. So yesterday, the update was that General Michael Flynn, who, not terribly bright, may not have properly disclosed his work on behalf of foreign governments such as Turkey, accepting money from Russia. And, you know, the Trump administration's first response to the House Oversight Committee and Chairman Chaffetz was to say that they would not release any documents pertaining to Flynn, and sort of denying any knowledge of it. What's great is that understanding that Flynn took money from foreign governments and served as a foreign agent of Turkey would require the incredible sleuthing work of Googling. And so here is Carl Bernstein. He was on CNN They're talking about it, and he you know, this doesn't take Watergate level reporting chops to put this together, but here he is saying that, yeah, there's probably a cover-up going on here.
I think it's obvious that General Flynn is in up to his neck in terms not just of possible crimes involving his speeches and whether or not he registered as a foreign agent, which he should have and didn't. There, he is central to what the FBI believes is a cover-up going on among people close to the United States, to the President of the United States, about what happened with the Trump campaign and Russia. The FBI, the congressional investigators, are trying to learn what happened. And Flynn is almost like the ball of yarn that begins to unspool and is key to understanding it. And the White House, President Trump, calls it a witch hunt of Flynn. It's not a witch hunt. He is impeding, the president is impeding these investigations by not turning over and saying to his people, give all those records about Flynn to the FBI, give them to the congressional investigators. Now, you have a situation today, a new Deputy Attorney General of the United States takes office. He's been confirmed by Congress. He's known as a real straight shooter. And he is going to go in and look at the facts now that Sessions, the Attorney General, has recused himself. And he is going to see, oh, my God, there's a cover-up going on. The question is, what is Mr. Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, going to do?
So you think it's going to go that way, that the disposition, the recalcitrance of the White House thus far to either give over information or
Let me say something about no, let me say something about what I say. The White House has obstructed these investigations, including the FBI investigation. But that doesn't mean in terms of a legal obstruction of justice. It means for practical purposes, the agents and those at the top of the FBI believe the White House is keeping them from learning what they need to know. And Flynn is central to that. Flynn's activities are central, his communications with the president, et cetera, central, and that's what the White House, Trump, is not allowing to be turned over.
Dead! So, you know, just a couple of brief points on this. First of all, we've said a number of times, I'll say it again, the sort of, there isn't some, I mean, more things will be revealed, but everything that we sort of know already is where the action is here. We know that General Flynn took money to go to Russia. We know that he had conversations with the Russian ambassador. We know, and I focus on this a lot, the relationship with the Turkish government, which, you know, incidentally, Donald Trump congratulated Erdogan on his power grab 2 weeks ago. So, and then we know Manafort, and we have a sense of Carter Page, and then we know that Donald Trump relied on Russia to for financing as well to some extent. So this is all in some variation in the public record. And of course, the Trump White House, I mean, maybe this is the only White House that could plausibly make the case that they didn't Google somebody's money taken from foreign governments. But I would imagine that even they were aware of Flynn's activities. So this is innately a problem that would apply in any scenario. It would apply if the government was Saudi Arabia. It would apply if the government was France. It would apply if the government was Israel. It would apply if the government was India. And it would even apply if some of the policy upshots are positive, like soothing tensions with Russia. It's also would apply if some of the policy upshots are awful, like selling the Kurds out to the Turkish government, or what the real play is with Russia and this White House, which is wiring the world for hydrocarbons and a interest in supporting far-right anti-Muslim governments globally, which I happen to have a problem with, a problem that does stop short of advocating war with Russia or red baiting.
It's because you're an imperialist.
It's because I'm an imperialist. That's exactly right. I don't want a foreign policy built on anti-Muslim bigotry and drilling every surface of the earth, which means I'm a Clinton shill. So the second point that is disaggregating the policy from the innate problem of influence peddling. And then number three, I like the way this conversation is going with Bernstein, because as we say, we kind of frame this usually as more of a question of crime or influence peddling than one of some grand conspiracy. And I think as this unravels and as this comes out more and more, what you're going to just see is the synchronization of venial, potentially criminal activity from many people around Trump, including Trump himself, self-interest in terms of career, winning a campaign, and then policy harmony. There's policy synchronization with Russia, with this White House, at least so far. Although now, maybe after meeting with Xi, Trump has a new best friend who's much cooler than Putin, right? And don't forget that everybody that Trump has ever made any commitments to, he usually ends up screwing. So that might bode very poorly for Russia. And we might be in a situation in several months where the biggest concern out of the Trump White House is that they're compensating and they're being overly hostile and saber-rattling with Russia. And this hasn't really paid off well for Russia so far, this play so far. The sanctions are not off. There's more heat on them. And it doesn't really look to be going well. But the interest going forward was people like Flynn that already have those connections, that are already making money, that are already doing lobbying and consulting, Manafort, that whole angle, and then whatever the direct relationships are with Trump, which I have no doubt that they at least indirectly are and probably constituted through some type of more kind of like, hey, I mean, you take money from whoever will give you money, right? And then a policy synthesis, which is let's drill. And the Putin government, since before September 11th, were saying that we should follow their lead with regards to their war crimes in Chechnya and that the defining security challenge of the age is terrorism. And they have a very similar discourse on lumping all Muslims together, committing incredible human rights violations under a rubric of fighting terrorism and civilizational blocks. So when you combine Russia, you know, I mean, let's just be logical about it. A far-right, social conservative, petrochemical state that doesn't like Muslims sound like natural allies of Republicans to me. This is Judith, Juliette Kayyem. She was also speaking on CNN to Don Lemon, and she just breaks down every aspect of Flynn and Manafort's conflicts of interests and how we saw it coming and why it's obviously completely nonsensical to think that the fact that Flynn didn't register as a foreign agent was some kind of mistake.
Yeah, Juliette, Flynn was paid $45,000 by RT. He sat with Vladimir Putin. He got $500,000 from a Turkish lobbying firm. Wouldn't the White House have turned up that?
I just want to say really quickly again, so people go, oh, RT's part of the influence peddling. Look, RT puts out some real good journalism. It puts out some real garbage as well. But again, the point would be if he took $44,000 for being on France 24, he would need to note that. Go ahead.
In their vetting or no?
Yes. I mean, by a Google search. So the White House will claim likely that they don't do vetting outside of what DOD or whoever was holding his security clearance did. But these stories about Flynn's relationship with Russia in particular, but there was also Turkey, were appearing by mid-2016. So it's not like, you know, when he becomes national security advisor a couple months later, that there should have been a surprise about some of his affiliations. So the person doing the review, let alone the White House counsel's office, would have known and been aware of the omissions. And just to pick up on what the colonel said, people outside the national security field should not believe that this is like onerous oversight, you know, that, oh, he just forgot. This is part of our blood in terms of who we are and the national security clearance process and disclosing every trip we make, even if we go to Ireland with our family or we have a friend who works for a foreign government. This is a part of, you know, it's sort of no different than a doctor having to, you know, take an exam. This is who we are. And so there's the idea that this was anything but a clear intent by Mike Flynn just has to be ignored. He has been in the business for too long.
Yeah, an omission, right? At the very least, it was.
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of us actually don't Google.
As I say, this is the only administration that can maybe plausibly make the case that they didn't Google. And she's right. It is about the process and the core dishonesty of it. I would also add again, and I know we already did this segment, but this was the lunatic who led the lock her up chants about Hillary Clinton. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. Let's actually just touch on this tax cut proposal briefly. So basically, Donald Trump is looking to get back in the saddle after what has really been a sad and pathetic, low-energy 100 days. Basically, what he has accomplished is Neil Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court, and that is going to be terrible for labor rights and equality, women's rights, civil rights, and everything that you would want in any kind of decent, developed society.
Be good for the revolution, though.
Yeah, good for the revolution. Oh, totally. God. Yeah. I mean, that's the type of... When Gorsuch got on the court, I still thought Stein 2020 was, you know, still on. But, of course, taking away, destroying the healthcare system failed. There hasn't been any other sort of broad domestic initiatives. Muslim ban was overturned. Now the sanctuary city money withholding is getting overturned. So everything else all he's done is just had a bunch of signing statements where he's reintroduced pesticides that give children brain damage. He's made it easier to destroy mountains and waterways and harm public health. And, of course, he's made it easier and less onerous on oil companies to bribe foreign governments. So I guess from a Republican donor perspective, it's been a relatively productive 100 days. But he needs something big and splashy because, frankly, it's just been sad and pathetic. So he has come forward, and the word out of the White House and Treasury is that there is going to be a massive tax cut package that's going to be released. And it's going to be centered around a cut on the corporate tax rate to about 15%. It's a classic trickle-down plan that's going from over 30% to around 15%. It's going to benefit shareholders. It's going to benefit the ultra-affluent. And there isn't an explanation of how this is going to be paid for yet. There's three different ways of doing this because this will explode the deficit. And we'll get to George Kalas, who is a senior tax counsel, to Speaker Ryan, who is shockingly throwing some cold water on this. But there's three different ways to move through trickle-down fantasy, give rich people massive amounts of money tax cuts, because it will explode the deficit, which, even though, you know, as we know, Dick Cheney said behind closed doors when Bush was pushing through his own inequality tax cuts that Reagan-proof deficits don't matter, but that's still something that Republicans like to pretend, obviously, particularly when a Democrat is president. So this will explode the deficit. So there is a border tax on imports proposal, which is something that Ryan has talked about and something that Bannon certainly supports, more of a kind of isolationist move, and may have an effect on the price of consumer goods. Then number two, there is dynamic scoring, which is what Marco Rubio is really interested in, which is basically like when a company like Enron counted as money that already existed, future deals that haven't happened yet. Like, you know, Matt and I are already multimillionaires because we've factored in, you know, offers that are happening in 10 years. And then what you do is you just drop that into your bank account, your fantasy account, and there you go, you have it. So what dynamic scoring does is it basically is like, well, obviously dumping this money on rich people, basically, even one conservative economist basically compared the plan to getting a helicopter and dropping bags of money on corporate headquarters across the country. After we do this, it's going to lead to such a spike in economic activity that, of course, it will pay for itself. And this is the old Republican trick. It's the old you know, trickle down mythology. And so they'll do a dynamic score that would say this. And then the third option is, well, man, we expanded the deficit. What are we going to do? Let's make more people hungry. Let's put more lead in more homes. Let's get rid of more environmental programs. Let's, you know, get back to the main agenda here, which is mugging working people, the middle class, destroying the environment, all the subsidized engineering upward financial redistribution, which is the Republican core agenda and core brand proposition. But they're not all on the same page on this. And so far, you know, the core problem that they have is getting this through the Senate, because it will explode the deficit, and which violates the Byrd rule, so meaning it can't be passed through reconciliation. So what they would have to do is, you know, end up passing something like the Bush cuts, which would, you know, last for about 10 years. And of course, do an enormous amount of social and economic damage. But this is George Kalos, who's an advisor to Paul Ryan. He's speaking at the Institute for International Finance in Washington, and he's throwing cold water on the proposal. This is the senior tax counsel to House Speaker Paul Ryan.
We tax people forget that people have other things to do besides worry about tax policy. I'll answer that, but let me first, I want to pick up on what Doug has said a couple of times, talking both about the constraints of reconciliation rules, as well as, Mark, you mentioning whether the White House might come out with a plan that has no offsets. And I want to, it's very, very important point here. A plan of business tax cuts that has no offsets, to use some very esoteric language, is not a thing. It's not a real thing. And people can come up with whatever plans they want. That is not only can that not pass Congress, it cannot even begin to move through Congress day one. And there are political reasons for that. Number one, members wouldn't vote for it. But there are also statutory, legal reasons why that can't happen. Doug and Mark were both talking about reconciliation. I want to pick up on that and flesh that out a little bit, because this is very, very, very important. There is this, I call it a magic unicorn running around, and I think one of the biggest threats.
Yes, exactly. Now you have my attention, magic unicorn. Go ahead.
There is this, I call it a magic unicorn running around, and I think one of the biggest threats to the timeline on tax reform is the continued survival of magic unicorns. People saying, well, why don't we do this instead, when this is actually something that cannot be done? And as long as that exists, it's hard to move forward by getting people to go through what the speaker refers to as the stages of grief of tax reform, where you have to come to the realization that there are tough choices that have to be made, and you cannot escape those tough choices.
Now, let's be clear that Paul Ryan's not talking about tough choices in terms of not giving more money away to Exxon or Chevron shareholders. He's talking about tough choices that need to happen in conjunction with massive tax giveaways, which is his undying devotion to decimating the meager social safety net that America already has. So the play there is not, look, even from a centrist perspective or whatever we want to call it, we can't prioritize something that would explode the deficit right now with very little economic benefit. The play there is of course we want to give tax giveaways to the rich. The whole Ryan healthcare plan was a attack on healthcare for middle class and poor people to give rich people tax cuts. And the Trump plan, which I will quote now just from Talking Points memo, just to get specific on this. President Trump will unveil Wednesday a proposal to slash the corporate tax rate from 35 to 15%, a change that will balloon the federal deficit by an estimated $2 trillion over a decade. The plan will reportedly include additional cuts to the income tax rate paid by high earners and a tax rate for child care that would mostly benefit the wealthy, further costs to the federal budget. Now, again, what Ryan wants is to pass a tax plan like this, maybe even a more aggressive one, a bigger giveaway. But he needs it to happen in conjunction with destroying Medicaid, gutting Social Security, taking away what little exists of remains of food stamps, and environmental regulations. Now, obviously, you know, getting everybody on board, they couldn't even come together to get rid of healthcare on a massive tax giveaway and destroying the social safety net is a pretty tall order. And it kind of makes sense that Matt Drudge is putting out the poison that Paul Ryan is just waiting on Trump getting out of there and becoming exhausted. And obviously, he clearly is completely mentally and emotionally unfit for the job. Ryan sees that too. He's waiting for Trump to get out of there. And here is the Drudge tweet. He's waiting for Pence to take over. And then, you know, they share the same agenda and they'd be able to kind of synchronize on this. But, you know, and I'm just going to quote now again briefly actually from Jordan Weissman in Slate. And this is the specifics of why a tax plan that would explode the deficit like that cannot pass the Senate. The reasons have to do with the Senate's budget reconciliation process, which Republicans will likely have to rely on in order to move any tax bill into law, assuming Democrats won't sign on. The procedure prevents filibuster on legislation related to taxes and spending, allowing them to pass to a bare majority. But it comes with a catch. Any legislation passed through reconciliation can increase the deficit out of the 10-year budget window. This restriction, known as the Byrd Rule, is actually written into federal statute. Now, they can make the tax cuts temporary, like the Bush tax cuts. That's one possible avenue. And then just to quote briefly from Juan Ryden, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan, Democrat from Michigan, indicated that she might be willing to negotiate on corporate tax cuts, which is garbage. No Democrat should be negotiating on any of this, but she was concerned about the number. And then Ron Wyden, who is good on some surveillance and oversight issues, but certainly not particularly progressive on economics, he did say this, which was important. I want tax reform proposals that work for working families, not just for people who can hire a lot of accountants and lawyers. Today, if you're a cop or a nurse, your taxes are exemplary. They come out of your paycheck once or twice a month. No Cayman Islands for you. But if you're someone who can afford lots of lawyers and accountants, you can pretty much decide what you're going to pay, when you're going to pay, and maybe if you're going to pay any at all. And that's exactly right. So from a Democratic perspective, this should be the same as healthcare, which is completely dead on arrival. This would be, you know, this is a massive tax giveaway to the rich right now. It would be the sort of social and economic equivalent of what the Trump administration is doing to the environment, which is essentially accelerating and deepening the crisis, which we already have a very limited time horizon to solve. And no Democrat should get anywhere near it. Now, part of the reason that he wants a win like this is because he just folded on shutting down the federal government over $1 billion in funding for the Great Mexican Wall, which shockingly Mexico is still not co-signed on paying for. Once again, I always say maybe if Tony Schwartz, who actually wrote Art of the Deal, was the dude negotiating this stuff, maybe it would come to something. Unfortunately, we don't have Tony Schwartz as president. We have the weird Buffon guy as president. And here is Rush yesterday lamenting the fact, because he saw it coming, that Trump was going to fold on the government shutdown without the dollars for the wall. Here's Rush predicting it yesterday.
I'm not happy to have to pass this on. I'm very, very troubled to have to pass this on. And I want to say at the outset that I hope my interpretation is wrong, and I hope this is not the case. But it looks like, from here, right here, right now, it looks like President Trump is caving on his demand for a measly $1 billion in the budget for his wall on the border with Mexico. The Democrats are threatening a government shutdown. It's the same old, and I was hoping that Trump would throw this shutdown thing right back in their face and have everybody realize they're the ones engineering these shutdowns, that nobody would notice anyway unless a big hullabaloo was made about it. The Democrats, Democrats seem to have successfully used this stupid, silly threat of a government shutdown to get their way. What Trump is saying is, if we need to get this done, then I'll delay the spending on the wall until September. And it's just a measly $1 billion. But the problem here is, folks, is one of politics. If this happens, if Trump does, and I use the word cave guardedly, Trump, I'm sure, does not ever think he caves on anything. But outward appearances are what they are.
Okay. Outward appearances are what they are. He caved. And it's actually the only play they have. What's amazing is that you're seeing the same dynamic play out with even the Trump people. The Donald Trump got elected president by, as many people pointed out, becoming like a Breitbart comment thread come to life. He is a deranged Fox News grandpa himself, and he sits in the White House. But even the dynamic is such that there is pure incentive structure for right-wing media figures and many members of Congress to always indulge the every fantasy and whim of the base and the donors. Because let's be clear here, this isn't a base versus donor things. The Mercers, the Kochs, and all of them, the only difference is that they're rich. They're just as insane and committed to absolutely demented ideology as any normal Republican voter, quote unquote normal. But what's great is that you're in the White House and you see we have record low approval ratings. We don't have a legislative strategy. Things are falling apart. Do we really want to shut down the federal government and get another several news cycles of pummeling? No, we don't. So we fold, like any rational political actor would. And now we're in the situation where Rush, who is really past the sell-by date and kind of like a figure of another era, really kind of out of step in the Alex Jones, Donald Trump Republican age. But even he is savvy enough to know that he has to break it gently to his audience that Trump is folding. I mean, even though, of course, Trump wouldn't call it that.
The truth is in there when he says, unless a big hullabaloo was raised. Guess what? If Donald Trump had a government shutdown over $1 billion for the border wall, a big hullabaloo is going to be raised.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Hullabaloo coming, Rushbo.
What would $1 billion even do?
It's symbolic.
It would just build
get
like
a couple
feet.
Yeah, I don't know.
Very literally, little. Like a few feet.
Maybe it would take that woman out of her house.
Could we do some blueprints?
Yeah, just do that.
Yeah,
the scale model.
Yeah,
of it would be great.
Would be like awesome.
In Zoolander.
Yeah, like in Zoolander. How this are we gonna? How are we going enough. To kick Mexicans out with this? All right,
I can just step over it.
Totally unfair. I mean, I am incredibly tall, though. We're calling from a 5. You're calling from a 515 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from? We'll take a call in the first half.
Hey, this is Sanjeeva from Ames, Iowa.
Hello, Sanjeeva. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm just kind of thinking after that Heath Mello incident, my friends looked up some of the voting records of Democrats across the state.
Yep.
And sadly, the Nebraska Democrats, more than half of them followed him in line. There's only 10 of them left in the unicameral legislature.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans have a super, super majority in Nebraska. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out what kind of coalition do we want? Like, FDR has Southern segregationists. Western
populists don't want those.
Who are very xenophobic.
Right.
And Northeastern liberals.
Right.
So, I just don't know what
you don't want a coalition.
I want to search for
here's what you.
I just want converts, not heretics.
Right. That's true, but you don't want a coalition with people who think being pro-life is one of the most important reasons to go to the polls. Like the way to build that coalition is to send the message that that's not the most important thing right now. And there are people, like I'm from North Dakota, there are people you're not going to reach with that message, but I think you have to be somewhat consistent. And I do think like there can, I don't know, like I don't know if you want to give much more than that.
Look, I...
Well, also, over the weekend, there was a 20-week abortion ban passed in Iowa, and one-third of Iowa Democrats in the Senate voted for it, and one-fourth in the House. So
yeah, so I wouldn't vote for those candidates, personally, to be honest with you. That level of attack on them, I guess, though, it's the same dynamic with everything else. I'd be looking for primaries, but I can't co-sign on that. Because women's health and women's bodily autonomy that's a fundamental issue. Just like criminal justice and race issues are fundamental issues. Just like inequality is a fundamental issue. Just, you know, there's a number of these things. I think there's two different points, Sanjeeva. One point is finding a middle ground there, and there is a middle ground, right? I think the thing that caught people's attention with Heath Mello was the people that had good faith, because we'll get to that second point in a second. But the people good faith, like me, it's actually being a co-sponsor of that bill, right? That's
mandatory. It was optional. But
That's another level of escalation than even if he had voted for that bill. Being a co-sponsor is a different thing. Now, where this has become, you know, the classic sort of corporate pseudo-woke neoliberal, Twitterati bullshit fest is that, you know, the same people that have had meltdowns and are freaking out about Bernie and he hates women and all this nonsense, they were the first out of the gate. And it was quite clear. Like, I remember when Hillary Clinton picked Tim Kaine. And we were clearly in mode of like, Hillary needs to win this. It isn't really the top priority right now to hack everything apart. We had to talk about certain things with Tim Kaine, including the fact that he had a terrible record on financial reform, which is another core issue in Wall Street. But then that's what I'm getting to. So then that was another thing that we mentioned. And I think that, you know, there are obviously a lot of people who, are totally disingenuous about this issue and using it to launch another bullshit campaign against Bernie. Because incidentally, by the way, if you're upset about this, you should be angry at Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Tom Perez. Every single mainstream Dem has said that there is room for pro-life people in the party, and Perez was also there campaigning with Heath Mello. So there's a deeper conversation of how do you appeal in different places where there's a different politics around abortion while maintaining the fact that, no, women's rights, women's health is a core commitment to any modern progressive politics, period. That's a complicated and hard question that we do need to figure out in good faith. People attacking Bernie as being uniquely anti-woman, they're just doing what they always do, which is being disingenuous, dishonest, and
a complete hack. Let's just get that out of the way. I think he's a complete hack, a Hillary Clinton dead ender.
Well, I can't comment on, you know, I can only comment specifically on this, and I've seen what Elisa Hoag has written about this has been total nonsense, along with everybody else, and that's commented on it. And it's pathetic, and, you know, that unfortunately, instead of having a serious conversation where everybody, including Bernie, is called into account, it becomes another, you know, hackathon from, you know, Hillary dead end and DLC types going after Bernie. And of course, incidentally, you know, none of these people said the same thing about Hillary Clinton naming her vice president, a guy who had anti-choice votes. None of these people were concerned about, you know, Hillary Clinton up until a couple of years ago saying, you know, abortion was a tragedy and the whole way that she framed that issue. Of course, during all of this period, Bernie always posted, you know, 100% pro-choice ratings. So yes, it's bullshit. There's people who have a weird, unhealthy fixation with Bernie, but he's not perfect either, obviously, and we need to somehow have a smart conversation about this and get where we need to go, and it's not going to be aided by these lunatics on Twitter. And I do hope in the
what
context
do you think about Labour's chances in England, though.
Sanjeeva, I'll get to that. I'll get to that in the fun half, Sanjeeva. I have segment on that, but it doesn't look good. But I'll get to that. Thanks for the call.
Yep.
Okay. I think that. Well, actually, let me just touch on this briefly. We've got to do sanctuary cities. So, a federal judge has struck down President Trump. If only it were so. Goddamn right. You don't call this orange-faced white devil President Trump. Basically, Trump challenged California jurisdictions in federal court after a federal judge withheld from him the ability to withhold federal funds from so-called sanctuary cities. Now, this is a very serious issue. This has major implications, obviously, for human rights, for the Trump Sessions war on immigrant populations. And as we've heard from Ronald Reagan, and I would check out his podcast, this, in the last couple of weeks, the war on undocumented people has accelerated to a new level. Some of the things that were happening the first couple of weeks that were terrible were things that might have also happened under Obama, because obviously Obama also had a far from perfect record, to say the least, on these issues. So this is an important issue, but let's get through it in a typical Trumpian way, which is that Trump at 5:20 a.m. fired off this tweet.
Bright and early,
up and at him. Fired off this tweet complaining about the ruling against him on sanctuary cities, and this is up on screen. First, the Ninth Circuit rules against the ban, and now it hits again on sanctuary cities. Both ridiculous rulings. See you in the Supreme Court. Couple of things. This guy is so stupid that he's gone back to calling it a ban. Do you remember how when the Muslim ban was first run out, was first turned out, and there were protests across the country because it was unconstitutional and it was cruel and it was a violation of human rights and it was an act of supreme hypocrisy and Islamophobia? And then that was struck down. And they put the country into crisis for a week. And then they went back and they tried to rewrite it and announce it differently. They brought out Kelly and Sessions, and it was like, no, this isn't the anti-Muslim fear-mongering that Trump campaigned on. This is a serious, judicious decision about our security. Even in that filing, though, was, of course, so disingenuous that they still couldn't find any actual examples of terrorist attacks or plans really emanating from any of these refugee communities. So one of the examples they used was from a Somali teenager who was been in the United States for years before any of this. You know, it was a nonsense ruling and it was overturned again. But the point was in the re-up, they weren't calling it a ban. So this idiot goes back to saying it's a ban. Then his second mistake was Judge William Orrick, who handed down, now I'm quoting from Politico, Judge William Orrick, who handed down Wednesday's injunction, is a U.S. court judge based in San Francisco and does not sit on the Ninth District. Although that is the next court that would hear the case should Trump administration appeal the decision. So Trump can be legitimately freaked out by the Ninth when they appeal it and they rule against him as well.
Close enough.
Some observers consider all federal courts in the state the Ninth Court, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, has judiciary to be collectively the Ninth Circuit. So, another fail for Trump, and at least a modest win in the preservation of rights for immigrant communities during the Trump Sessions era. We're going to go to the fun half, talk about Marie Le Pen, Emmanuel Macron, talk about Ivanka.
Jesse Waters, he should watch his mouth.
Jesse Waters should watch his mouth. And Mike Enzi, who doesn't usually make a lot of news because he's just a boring backbench hack from the Republican Party, had some pretty insightful comments about the LGBT community. We got to get to those. That and plus your phone calls. I see a lot of you are lined up and your IMs all in the fun half. Sam's live from Vegas tomorrow. Two Dope Boys and a podcast on iTunes. Check out our Amazon link and our Jet link. MR Spring 17. That's the code for the Just Coffee coupon. Get it while it's hot. See you in the fun half.
He says no.